Joe, we're back for episode 81, I believe.
Yes, it is, 81.
81. So, tonight, I think we agreed to talk about the war on drugs. The war on drugs. Now, that's a strange term, because what are they really declaring war on? Of course, what most people identify as the war on drugs is the efforts both domestically and internationally of governments to suppress the drug trade, prohibit the use of illegal drugs, the illegal narcotics. Obviously, there's the federal effort by the federal government, and also, at least here in this country, there's a federal effort, and then there's also the efforts of the local and state governments that work in conjunction with the federal government. I guess we can probably date the so-called war on drugs to the first anti-opium laws of the 1870s. They were directed at Chinese immigrants. The first anti-cocaine laws in the early 1900s were directed at primarily black men in the South. Anti-marijuana laws in the Midwest and Southwest in the early 20th century were directed at Mexican migrants and Mexican Americans. Today, some people say the drug enforcement laws against drugs that are primarily targeting still minorities, Latino and black communities. The war on drugs really picked up in the 1960s as drugs became kind of symbols of youthful rebellion, social upheaval, and sort of dissent. That's how they were sort of promoted, or at least advertised in the media. This is at the same time the government had halted scientific research in the drugs. We'll talk about maybe perhaps that MKUltra. It was in 1971, I think, that President Nixon declared a war on drugs, and he dramatically increased the size and presence of federal drug control laws. This also coincided with the closing of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, which was formerly the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. I think in 1973 it was folded into the Drug Enforcement Agency. This is the same time that the various laws were passed with mandatory sentencing and also the introduction of no-knock warrants, which were kind of given the green light by the courts. John Ehrlichman, who was an aide for Nixon, had an interesting quote about the drug war. He said, "You want to know what this was really all about? The Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand that I'm saying we knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and the blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest those leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about drugs? Of course we did." Nixon, at the time, I guess this was considered temporary, placed marijuana on Schedule 1, which is the most restrictive category of drugs, because most people familiar with marijuana know how ridiculous that is. This was done pending review of the commission appointed by Republican Pennsylvania Governor Raymond Schaefer. In 1972, the commission unanimously recommended decriminalizing the possession and distribution of marijuana for personal use, which most people don't know about. Of course, Nixon ignored the report and rejected its recommendation. Throughout the 70s, even President Jimmy Carter had supported decriminalization or legalization of marijuana. And then it came the 1980s and sort of the drug hysteria and the skyrocketing incarceration rates. This was, with the Reagan administration. This set the stage, like zero tolerance policies. You had Nancy Reagan, who carried out this highly publicized campaign, anti-drug campaign, Just Say No. Of course, in the 1980s, this led to the passage of a lot of draconian penalties in Congress, and also state legislatures rapidly increased prison sentences for drugs. This ballooned the prison population. We can get into sort of the deep politics and finances behind that, perhaps. Of course, this also coincided with Iran-Contra, which sort of exposed the hypocrisy of the drug war. We'll probably get into that. But we have, okay, so that's kind of like a brief, the war on drugs. And since then, it's been this kind of the same old story. We've had some pushback recently with some states like Colorado, California, legalizing the medical use of marijuana, personal use, and I think even in New York, you can carry a certain amount in your pocket as long as you don't expose it. It's not illegal. So there's been some retrenchment on the drug war at the state and local level, but not at the federal level. So there's sort of a mini civil war going on between the federal government and state governments regarding drug policy. But we have to ask ourselves, I mean, who really benefits from the war on drugs? Drug prohibition makes criminals out of otherwise law-abiding citizens. It costs the taxpayers hundreds of billions of dollars, has made drugs more dangerous. Of course, it's also empowered powerful criminal syndicates, increased violent crime, corrupted law enforcement at all levels, and expanded the size and scope in government. I think it was Wendy Kramer who wrote this. A sensible person might wonder why we criminalize the use of cocaine and heroin, not to mention marijuana, why we tolerate and celebrate alcohol consumption. Of course, we learned long ago that prohibition of alcohol was bound to fail, so a sensible person might propose that we consider ending prohibition of drugs like marijuana, cocaine, and heroin, which pose much less of a threat to public safety than alcohol, or at least reduce harsh penalties for their use. But sensible people have made little influence over the nation's drug policies. Well, I mean, we can look at the past 30, 40 years and declare the government's anti-drug crusade a failure. But of course, a failed government program is another man's success. The war on drugs has transferred vast amounts of wealth and power to those otherwise would have to do something else for a living. One doesn't have to be an expert in public choice economics to recognize that the drug war, like any war, is merely politics by other means. And those who benefit from it have no desire to see it anytime soon. Of course, the major beneficiary of the war on drugs is the federal government, the U.S. government, which in the process of enforcing or waging the war on drugs, has laid waste to civil liberties, and it's also caused erosion of rule of law. And the simple fact is, there's no way you can enforce the current drug laws while abiding by the Constitution. So the Constitution is a casualty in this war. We can talk about the huge profits that the drug war generates for drug dealers. We can talk about the booty that it produces for the the counter-narcotics agents who seize property in the name of the war on drugs, even without any due process. Forfeiture asset laws are very controversial, but very lucrative for government agents and government agencies. There's also the vast bureaucracy behind the war on drugs, which is the judicial system, the courts, the lawyers, the bail bondsmen, and these things. Perhaps we'll get into the long history of drug dealing or drug trafficking. That the intelligence agencies work with criminal cartels and these things in support of intelligence operations, black ops, black budget funding, and not to mention the alchemical role that the drugs play in society, the fundamental changing of society, degradation of society. So these things. So Joe, that's kind of a not so brief rundown. Sorry if I'm long-winded.
Fascinating.
So what's your take on this?
Well, I think, Tim, if you don't mind, I will start out with a description of my career as a drug dealer.
Uh-oh. Is the statute of limitations up yet on that?
God, I hope so. as a junior in high school, I was 16 years old, and me and my absolutely incorrigible friend, Steve Sewell, we had started smoking marijuana. Marijuana was $10 a lid. And a lid represented an ounce.
Yeah, I'm not into the street lingo, Joe.
Right. Well, I mean, this is as far as we knew that a lid was an ounce. Now, a key was a kilogram. Mm-hmm. That was 2 pounds. So that was more than an ounce. It was like 38 ounces or something like that. Now, you could buy a key for $150 if you could get together $150. So we thought, well, we should buy a key because we could then sell some marijuana to our other incorrigible friends and then have our own usage basically paid for and, you know, pocket a tidy little profit for, other activities. So we happened to know a guy who could supply a key. I won't give his name. He's probably listening right now. And Bruce was his first name. And so we got together our money. Now, bear in mind that we both worked for minimum wage, which at that time was, I think, $1.50. I was a box boy at Hughes. Steve worked for Charles Liquors in the Palisades. And he made more money because he got tips. Some of his clients at Denny were like Henry Miller and Horkenheimer, believe it or not. Yeah, they lived in Huntington Palisades. Another story. But so anyway, we cobbled together our money. We went to Bruce and we said, okay, we want to buy a key. And this was like, you can imagine the skullduggery of like 17-year-old, you know, like the transfer of money was, you know, in a closet or something. You know, we were going to meet him and we had it all worked out. I was in a car that was looking over the area and Steve would go down and get the drugs. And then he would drive off and I would kind of like be the security, you know, make sure there was no police, though there was nothing we could do except honk the horn because there was no cell phones. But anyway, so we gave him the money. We met at the appointed time. And so Steve said, well, where's the key? And Bruce said, well, I don't know. The guy left town. And he said, what do you mean he left town? He goes, I don't know, he went up north. Went up north? He goes, yeah, went up north. I don't know when he's going to be back. So that was my career as a drug dealer. I swear, that's exactly the truth. I mean, that was so disheartening. But it was kind of interesting in that, you know, the reason that you had to conduct this kind of activity was because, you know, these were very illegal drugs at that time. You know, marijuana was a huge deal. I mean, you would have, if you'd gotten caught with a lid, boy, you were in real trouble. And yet the whole thing was obviously a setup because in what I mean by that is that there the deep state was promoting the drug use of the baby boomer, right? Even though we were thinking that we were being free and liberating ourselves and escaping from the man by our drug activity, and we were oppressed and sort of like a, you know, this rebellious class, and this is so, it was quasi heroic. And particularly think about, you know, this is like with the Beatles music talking about Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, you know, stuff like this. So we were getting all this encouragement about the heroism, you know, of taking drugs. That was the culture we were in. But then it turns out, of course, that the secret society, deep state, was actually, these were just the ways they were getting us to think that this was a heroic activity. And I wanted to just mention at the beginning of the discussion that I hope everyone goes to the May 1957 Life magazine cover. It's on the internet. You can just Google that in and there it'll pop up. And you'll see that on the cover, it has a description of the Gordon Wasson story, which is the introduction of psychedelic drugs to American culture. You know, if anyone hasn't heard it, it's just this preposterous story, which is just demonstrable lie after lie, that Wasson tells about how he came across the magic mushroom and how it was a spiritual experience. But anyway, on the cover of Life magazine, you have what's called neurolinguistic programming, because there are three articles that are referenced inside of this black box. And the top one says Great Adventures. And then the next one describes Wasson's experience, you know, strange adventures in the Mexican desert. And then underneath that is are the words teenage allowances. Right now, the teenage allowances is what's called neuro-linguistic programming. In other words, they're trying to access the subconscious of people to get them to think that, you know, drug taking is for teenagers is allowed, is something that's good. I know this may seem far-fetched, but then you have to remember that this was an MKUltra project. This was sub-project 58. That isn't something that's open for discussion, and the documents, you know, detailing Wasson's pay requisitions and all of the other MKUltra mind control activities, many of which are regarding what can be called neurolinguistic programming, make it such a tidy package that I think it's just impossible to contest, in my opinion. It's just absolutely straightforward. So what they were doing is they were seeding our unconscious so that we would be all set to go when the Beatles came about. And then marijuana started appearing on campuses. It was just everywhere all of a sudden. It was really, you know, in the early part of the 60s, it was, you know, maybe, you know, 1 in 1,000 kids was doing it. But in my class, which graduated in 67, marijuana was just everywhere. Somehow it was just being permitted, I don't know, or whatever. It was just in the country. And then came the hammer blow because it was all incremental. In 66, we were doing marijuana. But then in 67, this strange drug came. It was called LSD. And that was introduced to my class through the Grateful Dead acid test that a couple of our classmate mates went to. It was in Watts, and the Grateful Dead played there, and they came back talking about how far out this whole thing was, LSD. So now looking at the Grateful Dead as more or less an outed government project, you can see that the idea that there was a war on drugs is just the cover narrative, right? They're not sincerely trying to keep these drugs from getting into the, you know, the boomer culture. They're the ones promoting it. Another, you know, point of reference is that is Ken Kesey, who, you know, was the first one to really push LSD out into the teenage culture in the 65 and 66 acid test. He was giving LSD out for free. You know, he claimed that they accidentally left it lying around in the Palo Alto lab, and he was able to get, you know, they were able to get it. Mm-hmm. And it was also known, something that was everyone in my class was aware of, is that LSD would be given out for free at Grateful Dead concerts. We were well aware of that. Everyone knew it. Now, again, they, you know, this was an incredibly complicated drug to make. But somehow we believe that these people wanted to help us liberate our minds from the, I don't know what you call it, but the negative, you know, police state culture we lived in, and that LSD would be the way to do it. And so that was, you know, hand in hand with the terror of the police state if they caught you. So I think you can see what the... you know, the war on drugs was, it was just part of the whole shattering of the psychology of the boomer. I mean, I took the war on drugs very personally, and I still do for different reasons. But I think it was, you know, as it became well known in the United States in the middle part of the 60s and then and going forward, it was just designed as the other half of the psychological trauma. The drug was one half. I mean, I suppose the music was like music was part of that. And then you also had the terror, you know, of like getting busted. You know, and so this, of course, is, you know, you mentioned that they would focus the laws on immigrants, you know, going back to like the Chinese coolies that came into the United States, right, because they're opium addicted. And I had to have a sad smile across my face when you mentioned that because, well, who addicted the coolies, right, that mm-hmm. entered the United States, right? This was, you know, this was Palmerston and the British Masonic crypto control that insisted on being able to sell opium and then to the Chinese, addicting them, then basically enslaving them. They were here. They were brought into San Francisco in these areas, you know, to work in the gold mines and things like this. But basically as indentured servants, many of them were addicted. And so now they have the second half where they have, you know, welcome to America. Here's your opium and here's prison. So, you know, what can I say? The war on drugs is it's a camouflage that the government can hide behind so it can conduct activities of theft by selling drugs to young people, incarceration and destroying, you know, the cultures that have to use drugs as their major source of income, having the manufacturing sector having left. And then it can also push drugs that it knows will debilitate because the government is obviously trying to Dumb Us Down. And so I just wanted to conclude by pointing out that this, the latest drug, I mean, we've had the OxyContin addiction of the United States. I mean, you've seen the statistics, I'm sure everyone has, just how many people are, what large fraction of our population are addicted. I mean, I'll just segue for a second. In Seattle, they have so much OxyContin getting into the waterways, the ocean around Seattle, because of, through the urine and just through people, you know, I mean, whatever, you know, passing out and floating in the river, that they can detect it in shellfish. I mean, that's how much OxyContin is coming out of Seattle right now. It's just a river.
And it's legal. This is a legal drug.
Totally legal, right. This is the legal, this was the, you know, and then so.
This is the Sackler family.
Yeah, this was the Sacklers who are just, you know, basically addicting them. Okay, so anyway, but then now you have the fentanyl. I don't know if you've been following this, but oh my God, fentanyl is just, I mean, it's literally OxyContin on steroids. It's a synthetic drug that they have learned how to make, which is, I mean, just to give you an example, I think it would be 40 pounds of fentanyl would kill everyone in New York City. 1,500 pounds would kill, it could kill every American. It's so potent that they think it's going to be a very effective weapon of mass destruction. In Russia, there was they use fentanyl as a tranquilizer in this terrorist activity. I don't know if you recall, but this one group had gotten in, it was an opera, and during the Chechnya thing, and they had at one point the terrorists got 800 hostages, right, in a theater in Moscow, and they were asking the Russians to withdraw from Chechnya, and the Russians pumped fentanyl into through the ducts. They incapacitated everyone, but they killed 100 hostages with just breathing stuff. So anyway, you can see that the future is bright for the oligarchs because, you know, they're really getting their technology together in terms of, you know, how the drugs can just wipe out whole. They wouldn't have to wage things like world wars anymore. They can use these drugs. And when we're talking before the show, you said something really interesting. You said, look, the whole, you know, the idea of, you know, like an illegal aspect to drugs, that came about because the moral bulwarks were eroded, right? I mean, that's really what led to so many people feeling like, well, they were able to use drugs for purposes that were, you know, wrong, because the moral aspect of it had basically been taken off the table, which it wasn't for my generation, right? When the people in the music industry were promoting it as hip and also as spiritually elevating. Mm-hmm. Gordon Lawson, you know. So anyway, that's something I'd hope you'd comment on is, you know, how did we get to the place where we have to use, or that the government is able to basically hide behind these laws, or and the society supposedly is protected by laws, when this should be something that is you know, is basically a family or personal, you know, matter of moral structure, you know?
It's a matter of public health and a moral issue, not really a criminal issue. Obviously, the crime, there's a lot of crime associated with it. That's the violence, because that's how illegal markets are negotiated, generally speaking. And your example, in the 1920s, people, gangsters were shooting each other over territory regarding beer distribution.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, you make something illegal, then all of a sudden that's just an opportunity for the black markets, and that's where the real profits are. And to the extent that there are laws against drugs, those aren't there to protect the public. That's there to effectively cartelize and manage the drug trade, because the government will use those laws to go after small time drug dealers, users. This as well as the prison population. There's a lot of money to be made with doing that. But at the same time, they can pick and choose what cartel to use and what cartel to discard, which is sort of the history of the drug war, whether it's the Cali cartel, or Medellin cartel, Sinaloa cartel, and these things. Well, one thing is, yeah, point out is the war on drugs is a fraud. So if you're a conservative out there and you're against drug use, and therefore you automatically think there should be laws against drugs, and the people who enforce drug laws are good people, and the people that sell drugs or use drugs are the bad people, it's not quite that simple. There's been, you know, several documented allegations and of CIA drug trafficking. In fact, they're legion. They're obviously the case of General Manuel Noriega. He was a drug trafficker for decades under CIA protection, which is now documented. He was paid $100,000 a year by the U.S. government. He wasn't taken out until he became a public relations liability and started to not cooperate regarding some of the Central American policies, particularly with Nicaragua, the Contras. I think it was Costa Rica. The Costa Rican Star, a newspaper down there, reported on a curious shipment of 24 tons of cocaine that was loaded onto U.S. Air Force transport aircraft en route to Miami. A plane crash exposed CIA drug dealing. This was, I think, 2007. A CIA plane that was used in its torture program ran out of fuel and crashed over Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. The jet aircraft number, N987SA, known to have been used for at least three rendition flights to Guantanamo torture chambers, was caught carrying 3.6 tons of cocaine when it crashed. Same plane. So connect the dots there. There was a U.S. District Court in Chicago. There was a hearing there, a court trial there, that one of the witnesses there called a logistical coordinator for a top Mexican drug trafficking gang. He was found to be responsible for purchasing the plane. So there you go.
Yeah. It goes way back. I mean,
you have Gary Webb's revelation, his reports in the San Jose Mercury News, what exposed about the cocaine importation, Central American operations, Vietnam, right? Vietnam War, Air America, that was funded a lot of the secret war going on in Laos and Cambodia. Vang Pao was a general there that was paid with opium supplied by Vietnam. Before that, there's civil air transport, and there was the Flying Tigers, and even as far back as the late 1930s, there was funding the Chinese nationalist, Chiang Kai-shek's forces. And once they lost the Chinese Civil War, much of their operations were paid for directly out of the opium trade. This was an OSS operation. This is legend. Figures like Barry's. If you doubt this, sometimes I'm talking about this, people are, you say, what are you, nuts? What are you talking about? And I say, well, just look up the career of Barry Seal or Paul Helliwell. Look up Nugenhan Bank. And you might get an idea of what's really going on here. There's a mountain of evidence to show this. And if you know how intelligence operations work, is because they're working, with secrecy, and they infiltrate various government agencies like the DEA, like the FBI, like the customs, or the FAA. They can infiltrate these organizations and allow for these operations to occur, not to mention, all the Air Force bases where planes can fly in without any customs. And that seems to be a pattern there. So, again, it's long since established of a heavy presence of federal agencies facilitating the drug trade.
Sure. In 43, the commissioner of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, which was at that time, kind of the cop of drugs going in and out of the country.
Was Anslinger?
Anslinger. He found out that Peru actually had built a cocaine factory. Now, this was done, as a legal structure. Yeah. They were trying to sell cocaine as there were medicinal aspects of it. So they wanted to sell it. He went in and the Economic Warfare Department confiscated before the product could be sold to either Japan or Germany, because they wanted control over it.
Drugs are a strategic asset.
A strategic asset. You've got it. And so then guys that have studied this actually, you know, got documents, and it turned out that that Anzigler was, even before the Vietnam War, they were shipping drugs into Southeast Asia, and with the idea basically of softening up the culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're working with this is a typical story. They're working with the drug traffickers. They're hiding behind them, right? So it isn't like they show up with U.S. Clothes on and stuff. They have Japanese drug dealers who are the mask, and then those individuals are actually the ones who are selling and making money. But in back of it was foreign policy, was geopolitics, and this was back in the 30s and 40s, you mm-hmm. know. So you can see that, and of course, then going back even another generation, you have the whole the creation of the Russell Trust through the opium trade, in China, which, of course, if you look at the families that are controlling it, we talked, I think it was last week, about Warren Delano, mm-hmm. FDR's grandfather. He was the number one. He was the head of, he was when actually when Russell retired and went back to Europe, to England, he was replaced by Delano, right? So this is where the family's vast fortune, you know, comes from. And of course, then when the family moves inside, when FDR becomes president, you can see that it's just that you have the public face, but within the government, you have the reality. And this is something that we suffer with to this very day, Tim. I mean, it's, you know, there's no doubt that if they wanted to actually win the war on drugs, they could do so in an hour. But I'll tell you, from my house, I can drive 5 minutes, and this is, you know, sort of a middle class kind of area. I could buy any amount of drugs I want to.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, California, they're you know, they have like marijuana is basically legalized. But I'm talking about cocaine, fentanyl, Oxycontin. You get anything on the street. There's no interdiction that's really meaningful, even though there are the state's prisons are just chock-a-block full of people who sell drugs, you know.
Yeah, and that's a profit-making venture there.
Yeah, so, another.
Yeah. The another case, of course, you mentioned another that illustrates this is Operation Underworld during World War II. That was the Luciano Project, when the federal government, the War Department, worked with the New York mob this was done to supposedly in support of the war effort, particularly against the fascists in Italy at the time, run by Mussolini. And Luciano was brought in. He was Thomas Dewey, who allowed for his release from prison. And of course, I guess he was later rewarded as being the Republican candidate in 1948, who famously defeated Truman, right? He was sent abroad because he had some information, I guess, because it was the Allies that worked with the organized crime elements in Italy to take out Mussolini's government. And so he was rewarded, of course, after the war, not only with the release, but also he was allowed, again, he was given the franchise. This was the so-called French Connection. I think drugs coming out of Turkey through Marseille into New York. And he was given that, more or less, by the OSS and by the War Department as a reward for his efforts. And so, again, heroin was facilitated, its transportation into the United States was facilitated by the U.S. government in support of a war effort, which became sort of a pattern, right? Whether it's Vietnam, Afghanistan, the dirty wars in Central America and these things. Whenever you have these wars, you see a lucrative drug trade flare, get created because these theaters of conflict are areas where you, sell a lot of weapons. And if you don't get cash, you get drugs. And the drugs then are brought into the country where they get the cash, where they turn around to buy the weapons, ship the weapons out again, get the drugs. Fly the drugs back in, courtesy CIA's infiltration of the LAPD or Federal Aviation Administration, or a conjunction with oil companies like oil rigs that, you know, these are infamously known, like Zapata Oil This connects to the Bush family as being drop-off points for drugs. Areas like Puerto Rico, once you get into Puerto Rico, you don't have to worry about customs. So Puerto Rico is a big drop-off point for drugs coming in from Central America. So there's a whole economic and also geopolitical, and as you suggest, social alchemical process going on here with drugs. They're just, same thing that they do with Chinese society, they've done largely done to American society and to Western society in general. Europe's the same way. Heroin was weaponized in Germany in the 1970s to undermine the left in Germany. And at the same time, they're getting the people who are supposedly against the system actually paying for their own demise, because the other one's paying for the drugs, financing the operation.
Yeah, I think that they targeted the black communities in America in the 50s with opium and heroin. Mm-hmm. I think specifically heroin. I really would like to – I haven't got data on this, but it was just epidemic in the jazz
yes.
world, that you had it's almost heroic, to have this addiction to heroin. And then that became, kind of the basis for heroin being hip within middle class kids.
Yeah, rock and roll being used to
And rock and roll. I mean, Keith Richards was, someone that you would think of as a heroin. He would be using heroin. You'd see pictures of him passed out. And this was sort of glamorous, right? We were getting programmed into thinking that it was somehow heroic and rebellious, to take very powerful narcotics. Mm-hmm. But I think that the African American community was just specifically targeted because they had the highest misery, since their culture was the earliest fragmented culture. They had the first really astronomical out of wedlock birth structure, and so that was during the time when these drugs were becoming really fused into their street life, and that obviously in light of all the things we've been talking about, that had to have been deliberate. I mean, they couldn't have been, manufacturing heroin in the inner city, right? I mean, they wouldn't know how to do that. There's no industrial chemical capacity for that. So the heroin was coming from other places, right? And so, to me, they were, I've said this before, I think they were trying to shatter that culture first, because their intention was to try to merge it, to merge the values of this shattered drug-addled culture with the boomers. And I think they, with particularly rhythm and blues music.
Oh, yeah, that was not just drug use, also the sexual rhythms.
And the sexual rhythms,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. Rock and roll itself is a term of fornication. Yeah.
So this was all, basically a weaponized anthropology, which these guys had a really good background in, so they were experts in being able to do it, because they'd already basically had forced opium into the culture in China.
Yeah, and also obviously the jazz scene in the 20s, and there was a certain decadence of the 20s, which I guess the limited mass communication and the lack of antibiotics inhibited. By the 50s and 60s, mass communication had developed to the point, and not to mention those of the demographics we've talked about in other shows, and I've done interviews about sort of the demographic warfare that was waged upon certain ethnic groups, particularly Catholic ethnic groups, to disperse these neighborhoods, ethnic neighborhoods, into suburbia, which was sort of a materialist cultural wasteland where the mass marketing of the 1960s would have its effect. And that was with television, rock and roll, stereophonic FM radio and these things. And so it definitely had its effect, something that maybe just limited technology wouldn't allow in the 30s and 40s. But in all good time, it would have its effect, its alchemical effect, and it has.
It's interesting. I have a friend of mine who's a black guy. And I called him up this week because I was curious about his take on the drug activity in black culture. And we talked about it, and he was giving me some, anecdotal stuff about how devastating it was, how it was shattering. And he said, obviously the opinion of African-Americans is that it just comes from whites in general. And there is some suspicion now, finally, that the government is in back of all this. And I said, and I asked him, I said, well, why do you think they did it? And he said, they did it because they wanted to preserve the white ruling class power. Mm-hmm. That's why they did it. And I said, well, you know, that doesn't really ring true in the light of the fact of how all of the damage that this culture, the drug culture, the rhythm and blues music culture has done to the white, you know,
yeah,
class. Like, so how do you think that happened? In other words, what I asked him was, is that if the destruction of your culture was deliberate and the government was in back of it, then wouldn't the same thing be true for what happened to the boomers, the white boomers? Because they followed the trajectory of drug use and out of wedlock births. There wasn't white ruling class being created with what was going on in the boomers. These people are completely shattered. And, you know, it's interesting. He really hadn't thought of it. He'd never really considered that. You know, that there had been the same group had targeted both class of people.
Yeah, and also that's a certain phase, or targeting the black community, then using the black community to spread the degradation or spread
it's alchemical.
That's done with sort of the promotion.
If you look
at popular culture, yeah.
If you read like the White Negro,
yeah, like that, the White Negro, yeah.
Like Mailer's book, where he really makes the case that, God, these black guys are so hip.
Yeah, they're free. They're spade kicks. They call
with sex and with drugs, and they're great musicians, and they just, this whole lifestyle is just this, you know, it's so infectious. It's just so easy to mimic them, you know, to want to be like them, and so you have these white guys mimicking.
Yeah.
Basically pimps and black males that are just going to go off a cliff, but, you know, Mailer is touting them as heroic.
If you look at the life of, even the personal life of Louis Armstrong or Charlie Parker, it's, you know, it's pretty bad. Not a model. It's something you want to emulate. Not a healthy society. And you could argue that either the artists are on the fringe and you can, you know, if they're behaving this way, then okay, that can't be that damaged. The only problem is their lifestyles are promoted as a model, you know, and so people encourage people to behave this way. And even if you behave this way, just in a mild sense, you create enough devastation in your personal life and your family, you know, with promiscuity, drug use.
Oh, of course.
You know,
but of course, they're always after, you know, shattering culture. And
yeah.
So then you have the music industry comes into existence, which I think is really just the drug, you know, kind of weapon in an audio form, right? Because it was when you in my I'm talking about my generation, when you took drugs, you always had the music. When you took LSD, when you smoked marijuana, when you used heroin. They always had the music as like a soundtrack to, you know, to taking of the drugs, and the music reflected drug life. You know, there was all these like cute little, well, like in Beatles songs, you know, like I get by with the help of my friends. I get high with a little help from my friends. You know, there was just almost every song had a kind of cryptic reference to how hip drugs were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, teenage allowances, right? So the thing is that, you know, and this is kind of why, like, see, like my friend, like why people have such a hard time understanding it, you know, because they look at specific things. They think about, well, the CIA, right? And they go, the CIA are bad, and the CIA was smuggling, you know, cocaine in, and therefore the CIA was responsible for it. But they don't recognize that the CIA is just a small part of a vast cultural, you know, invasion, because the cocaine in and of itself wouldn't be enough, right? You have to have all of the other attributes. The music industry has to do its part. The film industry has to do its part. The education system.
Well, even the institutions themselves, because there's a huge major conduit for the introduction of drugs to young people.
Yes.
To the youth, are the schools.
Oh, God. I mean, absolutely.
The schoolyard.
Yeah. So this is the thing, is that if you just focus on like the CIA as a,
it's like a Grateful Dead concert.
I mean, you can't see the whole, you can't really see what's going on. You have to think a little bit broader. It's all of the agencies, the secret society has all of these colors on its palette. It has the CIA for one, you know, shading. It has the music industry can do another. But all of these little colors and you know, propaganda facets are all designed in total just to make people think this is a really hip thing to do.
Well, it's also, it's like concentric circles, right? That's,
Yeah. And then you end up with now, you know, the OxyContin epidemic, which has actually gotten into the basically the demographics of European Americans. You know, where now you have in the last decade, you actually have a decrease in longevity, first time in history. Mm-hmm. And it's just fascinating. You know, I talk to people about this and then they go, well, you know, it's this, it's that. I mean, look, think about how technologic medicine is at this point, right? How could it be that now, at this point, we are starting to lose years of life? You see, it just really is an incredible puzzle that at this point, suddenly you'd start having, you know, all of these catastrophes, you know, kind of taking people into a shorter and shorter lifespan. Well, how about the, you know, instead of the idea that it's just kind of history unfolding, you know, the different explanations people give are just fanciful. I mean, I always say, have you thought about the idea that it's actually deliberate? You know, I mean, that this is basically a kind of, you know, birth control through you know, population reduction through chemicals. I mean, why is that such a hard thing to understand, particularly when you go back and look at the government relationship to all of the, you know, like the youth culture, the one was named Ronald Starkey, the Brotherhood of Eternal Love. I mean, he was like with Osley supplying all this LSD for the Grateful Dead and all these people. All these people had government and CIA backgrounds, right? So you have to just ask the simple question. I mean, well, this whole cultural pollution, this destruction, you know, is it deliberate, you know?
Yeah, there's a review of the movie Kill the Messenger. Kill the Messenger was a movie by Jeremy Renner, played Gary Webb. I think he helped produce it. And, of course, Gary Webb was a reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. His series Dark Alliance broke the story of CIA cocaine dealing or importation into the United States. A lot of it ended up in South Central L.A., crack cocaine. And he made connections between, I think it was Daniel Blandon, who was a CIA asset working directly with Freeway Ricky Ross, the biggest crack cocaine dealer. And they were. This is leading to the distribution of crack cocaine in South Central L.A. and the destruction of those communities. He made all the connections in this series of articles. He was run out of the business, journalism, for being too good of a reporter. And he committed suicide, allegedly. Shot himself twice in the head. But this review kind of sums it up. It's just I think it was Jeff Kleffman, I think, wrote this. Just like when I woke up and saw how 100 different puzzle pieces only formed a coherent picture when taken together, watching Kill the Messenger in isolation may result in one walking away with the feeling that the story of government drug dealing must be exaggerated. Sure, there may be a few bad apples, but let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. But first, take a look at decades of government complicity, collaboration, and encouragement of worldwide drug dealing from the forests of Nicaragua to the mountains of Afghanistan. Think of the hundreds of billions of dollars of drug money laundered through the largest and most prestigious banks on the planet. Contemplate the additional billions spent by taxpayers to fight a hopeless war that does nothing to stop drugs, but if anything, just takes out the government's small-time competition in the drug dealing business. Finally, review the network of industries making hundreds of millions in building jails, housing inmates, profiting off their slave labor, taking it together. This is something so diabolical it only belongs at the doorstep of a shadowy group like the Illuminati.
Well said.
And I was listening to you remember Mike Rupert?
Sure.
He was on, I think his blog was From the Wilderness, and he this is even before he was a LA detective who was he claims he was the CIA tried to recruit him to facilitate a drug dealing in LA, controlled assets. And he said he rejected that offer and exposed the corruption in LA PD working with the CIA, and was forced to resign. I think he presented the evidence to the chief of police, Daryl Gates. And he said he got the response that the chief only has about 5 to 10 minutes to give you in a couple of weeks. If you're still alive by then, make an appointment. And that's when he resigned. That was the threat he got. But he was detailing the how this works and with drugs, how drugs can be used. And he was talking about how a place like South Central LA, and this relates to the HUD scandals of the 1980s. And the foreclosures, and how drugs can be used to soften up an area for eventual gentrification. And this is, what they do is they pump an area with drugs, driving the crime rate up. Because every street corner has drug. There's shootings. There's people strung out on the street corners. Business people are being robbed at whatever businesses are there, drives the industry out. And, you might have bought a house with a HUD mortgage there a few years before for $100,000. And all of a sudden, because of all the crime, the property values dropped to $30,000. And a lot of people just walk away. And there's just this cluster of foreclosures. And then income investors who don't live there paying 10, 20 cents on the dollar for the house. Then they gentrify it. And his assertion is that this is a way that you can, for a decade or so, target a community and then gentrify it and make a profit off it. At the same time, making the very victims the ones paying for it, because they're the ones buying the drugs.
Yeah, I think that the best blueprint for the war on drugs is basically Huxley's book, Brave New World, mm-hmm. where you look at Soma as a tool of just control in many different ways, for the public. So I think that ultimately, with cocaine and heroin and now with fentanyl, for God's sake, mm-hmm. That it's just to keep the public in a narcotized state while they developed the technology for the slave state. I mean, that's kind of where I think, if I had to think about like OxyContin, now why are they doing that at this point? It's just so prevalent, just everywhere. And of course, it's leading into fentanyl. I mean, to me, they've kind of moved out of the idea of like making money or, shattering culture. I think this is actually more toward the idea of just wiping out the remnants of European culture, basically. If the fentanyl is actually, basically part of a continuum of different kinds of narcotics, right, that are there just to soften up and to keep people from, keeping them calm. We're at the last bus stop, Tim. I mean, there's nothing past fentanyl. I mean, it is that powerful of narcotic. And if people start taking it, they're basically just walk. I mean, think of a drug. Think of something that's like 100 times more potent than heroin. I mean, just think of this, how powerful this thing is. It just keeps people in an absolute corpse-like. I mean, they're literally zombies. Look at all these zombie shows on TV. What is it really representing symbolically to the oligarchs? I mean, fentanyl is pretty close that's the kind of mind that these people would possess after like a week of a bender on this thing. I mean, they would literally just be, they wouldn't have any human consciousness really in operation at all. So, you know, the to talk about the other side about, well, what to do about this, you have to try to reconnect to the moral bulwarks that would have been in place before they have successfully onset the drug culture. I mean, you know, you look at like the kind of how culture existed in Christendom, to use an expression, right? You know, where there was the Christian moral structure was prevalent. I mean, it wasn't perfect at any time, particularly during the feudal system, but at least as a structure of morality, it gave people a point, you know, kind of a reference for behavior.
Yeah,
that's been taken away, and now there isn't any. And so, I mean, you know, what would you say? Like, how do we? Is it? Do we just try to make the case that it's just this is the only way you can keep it alive is to have sort of the moral structure to say no, I'm not going to use any of these drugs. And it's particularly, these aren't like theoretical questions. I mean, you know, in where I live, people, parents talk about this all the time. Like, how do you talk to children, you know, at who are going into the public schools, because they know, the parents know full well they're going to be offered drugs in the playground.
Yeah.
So what in our culture do we have to offer the child that can bolster them so that they can say, no, I'm in fourth grade, I really don't want to get strung out on fentanyl.
Yeah, it's you know, it's not as simple. I mean, obviously, I think you know, the prohibition is a fraud, and therefore doing away with the laws probably is a step in the right direction. But then I hear that one of the groups, earlier groups advocating decriminalization was George Soros's Open Society. So maybe there's a trick being played on us here. But then again, you go back to prohibition does not really prohibit the distribution use of drugs, because they can be easily had. So that's not preventing it. But nevertheless, is sort of, if you, the drug law, the war on drugs, prohibition itself sets the stage, the financial currency, or it sets the stage where drugs are constantly promoted. What I'm getting at here is Cash and Austin Fitz talks about the red button problem. She says people are really don't understand just how integrated narco dollars are into the U.S. economy, into the stock market. There was a story in 1999 where Dick Grasso, who was then the head of the New York Stock Exchange, went down to Colombia to meet with the head of the FARC guerrillas, a communist group that funded itself by selling cocaine. And he didn't go down there to spread the good word, you know, convert them to Christianity or anything like that. He went down there to try to talk them into, and this is like in the New York Times, to invest their profits in Wall Street as opposed to spending it locally. And the head of the FARC guerrillas said no to him. And then that's when they started being targeted, because the fields they controlled were targeted by the DEA and the Pentagon. So the fields that the cartels that the US CIA supported would get market share, and then who had agreed to invest up in Wall Street. And the way it works is, you know, you'd know earnings to share, it's about, you know, 20, 30 to 1. If for every dollar in profits pushes the stock up like 20 or 30 bucks. And that's where you make money on Wall Street, is the stock value. So there's no law prohibiting the use of drug proceeds being vested on Wall Street. So there's a lot of pop-up there with drugs being vested on Wall Street. You know, when a drug cartel buys 1,000, you know, SUVs from General Motors and these things, that's how money's laundered. Or another interesting angle is Cash Donaldson Fitz makes this point, so did Mike Rupert, you may take notice of how many fast food places there are around. And they don't seem to be doing the volume of business that justify the cash flow they report. Well, these places are being used to launder drug money. And if you, you know, take 100, each one, you know, is used to deposit $100,000 a year in street sales into the Kentucky Fried Chicken or Burger King, any of these things. Well, these companies are owned by, you know, by publicly traded companies that are traded on Wall Street. And this is in turn, which a lot of people's 401ks are invested in this, their retirement plans. So they're heavily invested in the lucrative drug trade, which is destroying the community.
Yeah.
People aren't aware, and when they are made aware of it, they turn around. They don't want to know about it. That's when she talks to she spelled this out to an audience of 100 people, who you would say are interested. You know, they're showing up to listen to her talk. So this is a group that is probably more involved or aware than say your average crowd. And she said of 100, only one would be willing to press the button to end narcotic sales immediately if it meant that their 401k plans plummeted or their retirement checks stopped. You know,
yeah, she's a very good analyst. Yeah. And she shows how integrated the narco money, you know, is to the banking system.
Yeah.
And I for a number of reasons, I would, if, you know, I mean, there's no good choices at this point. The culture is such a cesspool. The drugs have been so successful in terms of demolishing, you know, our intellect and our moral structure that there's just little left to fight over. But if I had the power, I would legalize everything.
Yeah.
I've seen the statistics of what happened in Portugal. Mm-hmm. And they have about a 20-year database now of complete decriminalization. And what they find is that the drug use doesn't go up much. There was, of course, the moral argument that there would be this enormous increase in drug use if it was legalized. But that didn't happen. The interdiction evidently just didn't really do much in terms of drug use, at least not in Portugal. And they had a lot more money for... you know, basically, you know, psychological.
Yeah, because people no longer feared of being prosecuted.
Because they weren't having to prosecute, yeah. But everyone had to incarcerate everybody. But I think in the United States, the real benefit, the reason I'd like to, is because I'm just really curious as to see what the economy would look like if we actually, if all of the narco money suddenly turned visible. You know, are in this.
Yes. Yeah.
Here, one, yeah, the other. But in other words, I think, you know, I've said many times, I think our economy is it's a hologram. You know, companies like Amazon have $1 trillion valuations. They can't even make any money. And fantasy companies like the fast food chains are also, you know, enormously successful. But, you know, the food is such crap, you can't believe they can actually make any money at it. But how does it work? Well,
yeah, which is killing more people, the drugs that are laundered?
You know? Yeah, I don't know, but you can, like, there's like a McDonald's that's on the corner of Century and Sepulveda, I think, and it's near LAX. I mean, it's just an obvious drug hub. You know, you go there if you're ever in town and you need some fentanyl, check it out. But you can see how the fast food is like a great place for the drug dealers to hang out. And there's probably some relationship, you know, between that actually the money starts funneling in. But most of the money would come funneling in from the back end, which is to say that the oligarchs, they're the ones that are selling the drugs to the street drug pusher, right? Mm-hmm. Or they're actually selling to some wholesaler who then passes along to these guys. But then that money comes back in. That's the liquidity that ends up in the bank, and that is our interbank lending system.
Yeah, yeah. The UN talks about how the
drug... Yeah, people like you and me, we don't have any money, Tim. We don't have any, like, surplus cash to put into the banking system, which can be lent out the next day and, you know, for compound interest. So the people with the liquidity are the drug dealers, you know? And so that's why... I would love to just legalize everything because I think it would be one of the ways we could actually start to see what our reality is. You know, we start to break apart the fantasy of living in the United States. And I don't think it would hurt any it wouldn't increase the damage to humanity.
Well, a couple cases of that's how what the effect of the war on drugs is, not just. Let's say even if they only target people who are actually using drugs or selling drugs.
Yeah.
Okay, which is, you could say is bad enough, particularly users. I mean, the fact that prisons are so full of, like, users, simple users, how the way, grants and funding work to escalate the war on drugs. Local police departments, a lot of the hardware they get, money for swollen payrolls depends on this continuous war and an escalation of that war. Much of the militarization has occurred with police in the past 20, 30 years is driven by the war on drugs.
Yeah, and, SWAT
teams.
Comes out of the Patty Hearst thing, but believe me, like in little towns like ours, we've got a SWAT team.
Yeah.
We have a big fascist mobile. We got a giant fascist mobile that's like this giant tank that can run over any building. And it's supposed to be basically for like drugs.
Yeah. Right? You got to ram the door down, right? No, not great. It's good examples. You can't abide by the Fourth Amendment. You can't enforce the war on drugs and respect people's right to privacy or their actually rely on warrants. You have to have no knock raids in these things. And, who's to say, a good example is, we can't make a police accountable for getting the right address. So when they go to the wrong house and shoot up someone's dog or kill someone's grandmother because of they're trying to find a couple of marijuana plants. Well, that's war, right? That's the attitude. But there was a case, and I think we mentioned this. There was that. I believe he was a ophthalmologist who was into like homeopathic care and all this stuff, and his son. This is his son was charged with vandalism. And what happened is they used the vandalism charge to target the family, and there was a raid at the house, and they found all this these chemicals that could be used for drugs.
Right? Yeah, they were there.
Yeah, and the thing is, they ended up charging him as being a drug distributor. And yeah. The point is, they had no evidence, but the point is they need a certain amount of arrest a year to get the funding.
Yeah, and also they've got the public.
Yeah.
Sort of conditioned into thinking it's okay to raid drug dealers and everybody can be a drug dealer. So they've expanded the police state.
Yeah.
Because the public is just so used to it. It's sort of like the drug dealer and the terrorists all live together in these little houses, which the police are always entering.
We had a case here locally where a mayor of a town was subjected to a no-knock raid and terrorized by local police. And what happened was the U.S. Postal Service is used by drug dealers to ship drugs. And what they use an address, and they ship the drugs to the address, and someone intercepts the package before the homeowner arrives. This is standard practice, for what I understand. And I guess the counter-narcotics police are somewhat savvy to this, aware of this, so they investigate these cases. And apparently someone was sending like a pound of marijuana to this address, ended up being a mayor of a small town. And then the package arrives at his house, and he comes home, puts on his sweatpants, wearing his loafers and t-shirt, and all of a sudden he looks at his front yard, and he got a SWAT team storming his house. They knock the door down, kill his two dogs, almost give his mother a heart attack, terrorize his family. And they do a little investigating. They found that his dress was just being used. But yeah. they don't give it an apology. They make him pay for the door, and that's it.
Well, and it's just that action is just obviously unconstitutional.
And it's so reckless, yeah.
It's reckless, but it's unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. You have to have a warrant. And so this would be, it's an example of they've really gotten a lot of mileage out of the drug war on drugs, haven't they?
Yeah.
Think of how much propaganda they've got in our minds.
Well, same thing with the war on terror, right? Justifying you with terror.
Yeah.
Exactly. Due process, right? You can't give terrorists due process.
Right.
How do you know you're a terrorist without due process?
Right. Yeah. Well, circular. Don't ask these guys questions. Just get, we're going in. We're going to arrest everyone. So
Jack Barrett can't be, restrained by the Constitution. He's got a job to do, right? Got to be able to cut off thumbs and torture to find the truth.
Oh, man. So we, the public has just got to try to insist that the war on drugs come to an end, and that the Constitution and the war on the Constitution come to an end at the same time, because Oh man, I mean,
Well, it's funny because at least at the federal level, the federal laws against, I guess, interstate drug distribution are completely unconstitutional because it's not interstate commerce. And good example, when they passed prohibition, however ill-conceived, they passed an amendment. They passed an amendment, and then Congress passed a law. So back then, they realized, well, we just don't have this power. We have to pass an amendment. And they got the 3/4 of the states and these things, and they passed an amendment. The 19th Amendment. Of course, then the 21st Amendment repealed that. But drug prohibition, at least up until the late 1960s, was done under the pretext of taxes, tax law. And it was always a failure of a stamp tax. So it was always the pretext that that's why you had treasury agents, right? Department going after this. And L.A. Ness was,
ATP was the Department of whatever it was. There was tobacco, firearms, and drugs,
in
basically.
drugs, yeah. And it's funny because there's a reason, one of the impetus for the crackdown on marijuana was once they got rid of prohibition, they had all these G-men who had nothing to do. So what's a bureaucrat to do? Well, find a mission. And so they use the tax laws against marijuana and these things. And for the better part of I guess 40 years, they had these laws against drugs, which were based on tax laws. And then I think it was a Supreme Court rule in 1969 that did declare it unconstitutional because the federal government never issued a stamp. So it's bad faith on part of the federal government. But then but in 1968, the Congress passed the, I think, Dangerous Drugs, Dangerous Drug Act or something. I forget what the actual law was. But by the late 1960s, they didn't think they needed to amend the Constitution. But really, there is no constitutional basis for the federal war on drugs.
One of the things that they're using the drugs for, at least here in California, is they're saying this is why we have to get rid of cash.
Yeah, that's another thing. Yeah, that's why
Because,
they got rid of was it the $1,000 bill out of circulation? And now they're trying to
absolutely.
get rid of $100 bills.
Yeah, because see, it's too easy for the drug dealers.
Yeah.
Right? If they had to use their credit cards, we could track them.
Yeah. Drug dealers and terrorists, the ones that use cash,
Yeah.
huh?
I mean, so then you have your credit card and your self-driving car, and the government, it's going to be a little tough to like make the old drug drop off, won't it?
Or misbehave in any other way, for that matter, right?
When you're being tracked,
Yeah, well, they're moving towards what they call a social credit system, I think, that have like sort of this gamification of life and these things. And a lot of things are leading that way. And guess another thing where you have to step back and see the bigger picture. There's a lot of incentivizing these things. This started with if you talk, discount cards at stores that track your every purchase. A lot of this is just based on marketing, but also I have to figure it's being fed into a database that's sold to like insurance companies, life insurance, health insurance companies. So every time you buy something, they deem to be unhealthy, or they'll tell you how to eat and these things. Of course, they never tell you to eat healthily, by the way. It's not really sound advice. Good example, your every purchase, to the extent that you purchase things electronically, that's all being monitored. And that all goes to how you're marketed, how your commercials that end up on your website. At the same time, also the monitoring your behavior. This is full information awareness. And the drug war is a great
Yeah,
ex
just
excuse for
another
that.
excuse. That shows that every little freedom, we have to fight for. In California, they've made a big deal about, I don't know if it was the story in the back east, but some guy was in a Tesla and he was drunk and he passed out. Did you hear about this?
No.
Okay, so the guy's he's in a Tesla, he's driving along and he passes out. The cop comes alongside and he sees him just face planted against the steering wheel. And so the cop doesn't understand it, and he notices it's a Tesla. So they contact Tesla, and they said, "Yeah, the car's is autopilot; it's driving itself." And so the guy is just completely passed out. And so the cops pull. The Tesla told him what to do. They said, "Go in front of it, and then slow down, and then have a car on the side too, so the car has nowhere to go, and then it'll just come to a stop." And so that's what it did. But I mean, I don't know if it's a real, I mean, I don't know if, I mean, it's a real story. I don't know if this actually happened, because it seemed to me a little quasi-suspicious, because they're trying to make the self-driving car a hero, right? Save the drunk from himself.
Yeah.
But you can see how they want to onset this technology of you know, of complete control, where you don't even have the ability anymore to like drive your car someplace, you know,
yeah,
without.
Yeah. And again, and if you misbehave in a way that the powers that be don't approve, if you behave in a way they don't approve, you misbehave, they'll shut you down. Your car won't start. Yeah.
And then your credit and your like cash account just lost, you know, 50 McDonald burgers, you know.
Well, and if you doubt that, look at the sort of the clampdown on internet, you know, with whether it's Patreon or PayPal.
Absolutely. You know, one thing I've noticed is that
payment systems being used.
It's even like Google now. The search engine has been algorithmized. You know, they if you type in something like Holocaust fraud or if they had that, like that woman Nellie Sachs, whatever it was. Google had a big thing on her. She'd written Holocaust poems, and I was curious if there are people who are writing alternative, you know, explanations of her poetry. I was just wondering if, because I really didn't know much about her, but she had her a day commemorating, you know, her poetry. And I could see that what they had done is they now have the search engine with these kinds of filters so that, you know, you just don't have access to the alt media anymore through Google.
No, the searches are, I've done searches in the quality of the results has really, really gone down the past few years.
Yeah, and you can see how they addict you to the use of the thing, and then they start to use it as a control device.
Yeah.
You know, and so now obviously the war on drugs is just, it just gives them, this is the rationale, you know, drug dealers and terrorists, those handy Swiss Army knife gadgets of, you know, the oligarchs, where they can always say, look, you know, we're trying to act in the interests of the society, and it's just these terrible people that are doing these bad things. You know, it's nonsense. Public has to be aware of this, that the war on drugs is, you know, to me, it's almost so fake that it'd be something you would think would be like a rallying cry, that people could see, you know, this has to be part of it. This is obviously artificial. It's obviously, you know, the government is in back of it. And there's a broader, more malevolent structure that this is just part of, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the war on drugs.
Well, the drugs have always been used. I mean, from the beginning of their mass marketing, I think it dates back to the British East India Company, the opium. They were the first to really mass marketed this product directly to the Chinese. But the original purpose of the opium trade was to, reverse the balance of trade so the British continue to obtain tea without losing precious metal. But at the same time, they also realized that it was a great way to soften up and degrade Chinese society so it can be exploited. And that's the model today. And it's, whether it's Chinese or Americans or Europeans, it's the same thing. It's the same business model.
And don't forget that the opium wars are one of the great blueprints of real truth that we could ever have, because Palmerston was the head of the British Masonic forces that went up and blew up the Chinese, you know, who were trying to resist it.
Mm-hmm.
He was the head Freemason in the Orient. Believe it or not, I know this is like a hard thing to imagine, but he was, before he was prime minister, he was the head Freemason, the head poobah. He was also the owner of the largest states in Ireland, had the most serfs on them. Virtually all of them died in the Irish Holocaust, mm-hmm. right? So this is one of the most, just, you know, I mean, he's dealing with humans as basically non sentient aspect, you know, they're just like animals. They're barely even like animals, you know. He's just killing them in right and left to get his way. And then but for some reason he said, you know, the Jews, we just, that was the time for them to return to their homeland, you know, 1842. So you just have to wonder, well, gee, they get their homeland back and he's so nice to them, but what happened to the love of the Chinese or the Irish?
Yeah. Some reason they didn't rate.
They didn't rate somehow. You know, it's a big mystery, Tim. I think we need to get to the bottom of it, but we're too stupefied with drugs to think clearly. So it's going to be hard. Yeah. So it's the war on drugs, very personal thing to me, because, you know, when I was a kid, I Saw Drugs, I was excited by them, all the music, you know, that was like luring, you know, me and my generation to use them. And then, saw the Police State, you know, how you had to battle against it in order to have access to your drugs. And then I saw The Casualties. Remember, this was the era when LSD was being given out to children basically everywhere. And I saw, like, people, my friends, you know, end up in mental asylums.
Yeah.
This was all within 2 years. I mean, This was like from 1965 to the end of 1967. I saw that whole arc. I experienced it. And so, yeah, the war on drugs was.
We can't take the war on drugs or the creation of the drug culture out of the context of what was going on culturally and morally, which was weaponized anthropology. You had the destruction of the Catholic, primarily Catholic urban neighborhoods, the migration north. Of blacks in into these areas to create white flight. At the same time, you have the destruction of the black family being promoted by government programs. The Great Society, also the popular culture with the blaxploitation films, the music itself and these things. The whole entertainment industry, at the same time that there's this crackdown on the war on drugs, drug use is being promoted by music, by the corporations, by movies and these things. So it's you know, through the radio and these things and movies. So when we talk about, you know, how do we deal with the drug problem, we doing with prohibition, you get rid of a lot of that corruption, solves a lot of the problem, but then you have to address sort of the other social alchemy we've been subjected to, which is the destruction of family life, community. These things, all of these things, the destruction of community, the destruction of family life, which was targeted by the federal government, by the think tanks, by the secret society, if you will.
The single mom and the pornographic male are so miserable, they have to have drugs.
Yeah, they think you can't, if you want to address the drug problem, maybe you have to reduce illegitimacy and the divorce rate in single parent families.
You know, to set up a kind of a social structure where social animals feel at ease and at peace, right? Because it isn't out there at the moment. I mean, everyone is on edge. Like I said, the single mom and the pornographic male, these guys are jumpy.
Yeah, but then you see, this is the pornographic revolution. Now pornography is now free expression of right. You have to talk. Yeah. You have to attack feminism. The whole idea, you know, we have to revert or kind of rebuild a sense of traditional family, natural, traditional, healthy family life. And you got to repeal feminism. Boy.
Well, we're social animals and not going to be able to rebuild a solid social structure for people to live in, starting with transgenders.
Yeah.
You know, that isn't going to be your like starting lineup. You can't like go, well, let's have like a great society of it. We can like all kind of be ourselves and let's start out. We'll get Caitlyn Jenner.
Well, I mean, we're all being led to believe in these narcissistic fantasies, right? That we can just indulge ourselves. We can be ours. Yeah. Well, it's all about us. Well, that's impossible. That's impossible. Cause, no one human being is strong enough to stand up against this. You're going to need community. You're going to need some sort of corporate representation. From the very get-go,
this gets into a deep. In my opinion, you are Tim. You just, as always, your intuition and your reasoning are absolutely spot on. If you look at something like Nausea, like Jean-Paul Sartre, or Genet's works, or even Camus, they are setting up the individual. In his isolation as heroic, right? Yeah. And I know this may seem like, you know, weird and artsy-fartsy, but I'm telling you, it's all part of the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's all part of the atomization, the individualization of the European, that they would make these existential losers heroes, right?
Yes.
No family life. They have nothing they can connect to. They have like a drift in and out of sexual relations. They have no tangible fantasy. If you look at like the beginning of The Stranger, it starts out, you know, mother died today or was it yesterday? You know, I mean, right off the bat, you've got this like complete lack of feeling about anything to do with family. And yet this character is supposed to be heroic. So this is all just propaganda moving us into a really bad place, you know, because the isolation was the goal, and we didn't understand it, you know. They isolated us from our racial roots, right? They created this idea of multiculturalism. They isolated us from our sexual backgrounds. You know, you get the fake feminism. And then you even get this nonsensical, you know, existential hero that, you know, is somehow that the idea of just being by himself is a heroic achievement, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is just ludicrous, you know, I mean, it's ludicrous on the level of an informed social being, which humans should be, right? We are social animals. We should never let our society, our ethnicity, our family ever be attacked. You know, we should always defend it. But they were able to get us to buy it as heroism and rebellion against something that was, you know, boring and unreasonable, you know, authoritarian personality, you mm-hmm. know. So anyway, war on drugs, man, it's just completely fake. You know, good God.
Declare victory and go home.
Let's declare victory and go home, brother.
So, okay, Joe, let you go.
Tim, best of holiday wishes. Can I say Merry Christmas to the Kellys without YouTube shutting us down?
Tis the season.
Supposedly. Yeah, tis the season, and we'll get them next week, boy.
Yep. Enjoy your weekend.
You too. Bye. Talk to you. Bye bye. Thank you.